You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 23rd, 2025, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Was it Buenos Sera? Is that what you
Bona
said?
Buonasera.
Pardon me.
Yeah, so I just got back from a week in Sicily.
Sicily.
That was a beautiful, beautiful country. Very
beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's really different. So, you know, it's deserty scrubland, but not that dry. There's lots of trees and olive trees and stuff. But, you know, it's not like forest. It looks more like Arizona than like Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there are prickly pears, cactus all over the place. Even though it's not native, it was introduced in like the 1500s, but it's been such a part of Sicilian landscape for so long, it's like part of their culture now.
Yep, it's stuck around.
Yeah, very lovely. And the cultural history is amazing because, you know, obviously there were the Greeks were there, then the Romans were there, then there were a lot of Arab occupation there, and they eventually unified with Italy, so they're, you know, obviously part of Italy now. But they have all these different cultural elements, you know, still present. And, you know, we went to, I think the most amazing thing I saw when I was there was the Valley of the Temples. It's also called the Hill of the Temples. It's like a hill in a valley. So sometimes it's
Valle di Templi.
So yeah, the Temple of Hercules is the best preserved Greek ruin in the world, like Greek temple.
Whoa.
It's not intact, but it's pretty complete. You know, all the columns are there. And there's a bunch of other ones that are in various stages of ruin, but it was cool. Very, very cool.
Were you able to visit all the major cities, you know, towns?
A lot of them.
Palermo, yeah. Messina, Catania.
Yeah, we went to Catania, went to Palermo.
Syracuse.
Castellammare. Did not go to Syracuse.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, we had, you know, what was it like? We had a full week, you know, so.
Steve, did you see anything that might indicate it was a ruin from World War II or anything related to the war?
So not directly, and I asked about that on a couple of, you know, pretty much every tour that I took. So apparently all of the damage done in World War II was repaired.
Wow.
So most of the time, Catania was bombed, you know, pretty significantly during World War II. And they pointed out this area here was, you know, pretty demolished, but it was completely repaired, you know.
Mm. Oh.
And then there were some places where, like in Catania, it's interesting because, you know, it's right in the shadow of Mount Etna, which is still an active volcano. And at some point in the last 100 years or so, a lava flow extended the area of the land, basically extended the shoreline, so that all of the, like, the castles and defenses were now no longer on the ocean. They were on the Mediterranean. They were inland.
I see.
And so they were not strategically important because they were, like, no longer able to defend a port. And so they were not bombed during World War II because of that.
Oh.
It's interesting. The whole place is, I mean, it's obviously a volcanic island. Like, Catania is all lava. Everything's made out of blocks of lava. All of the squares had lava stones.
I wonder if that's a good building material.
It is. It's a very strong, very good building material. Although they had an earthquake in 1690-something, I think, and it was devastating. It was like it flattened the entire city. And our tour guide said they basically, there's the before time and the after time, right? Like the city was completely rebuilt after the earthquake. But you know what structures withstood the earthquake the best?
What would have withstood the earthquake the best?
The Roman foundations.
Oh, but they're concrete.
Yeah,
huh?
They weathered it very well to the point that they actually built buildings on top of the Roman foundations because they were so strong.
Yeah, they had the good stuff.
Yeah, that concrete just was, yeah, we've talked about this before on the show, you know, how it even got stronger over time. So they stood when almost every other building fell.
Now, more importantly, Steve, you mentioned that they have very dense meatballs there.
They do. Their meatballs are very meaty. The meat to breadcrumb ratio was different than what we're used to. It was more meat, less filler.
How did you find that?
They were great. They were different, a little different. You know, they weren't as, I don't know, fluffy as what we were used to, but they were fantastic. The food was good. The only thing is it's very heavy seafood, and I'm not into seafood. So that, you know, pretty much anywhere we went, like half to most of the menu was seafood.
Yeah, and the big cities or towns are on the coast, you would expect that, sure.
Joss must have loved it, though, Steve.
She did. She had, every night, she had some different kind of seafood.
Steve, was it only Sicily? That was the entirety of your trip?
We started in Malta because my wife had a conference there. So that was just a weekend, a Thursday to Sunday, and then a full week in Sicily. And that was, that was not enough, really. We were, we drove all around the island.
Look how tiny Malta is on the map. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but it's a good...
It's a speck. It's a speck right in the middle of the Mediterranean.
Yeah. It is a small island. It's a couple of islands, but yeah.
So you fly there, Steve, or take a boat?
We took a ferry we flew into Sicily, took a ferry from Sicily to Malta and back. That was an hour and a half. I say ferry. It's like a ship. You know, it's like a smallish cruise liner, but it was...
Is it like the one we took when we visited the Great Barrier Reef?
No.
A ship like that? Larger.
Much bigger.
Yeah, I see.
Much, much bigger. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, God, the water there looks amazing.
So the Blue Lagoon was filmed there. It was, beautiful. Yeah.
Wow.
Look at that.
Wow, wow. Well, I got to put that on my list. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it was very, very beautiful. Obviously, a lot of movies are filmed there because it looks so old, and the first season of Game of Thrones, for example, the city of Medina in Malta was King's Landing. So, of course, that's part of every tour now. This is where
here it is,
Ned Stark was killed,
Oh, my gosh. They're doing what Lord of the Rings did to New Zealand.
Basically.
Game of Thrones did to Malta. Very cool. And it was just the two of you. How nice.
It was.
When was the last time? And who? It was just the two of you, right?
Yeah, that's what you said.
When was the last time the two of you just took a vacation this somewhere? A
couple of years. We went to Bermuda a couple of years ago.
Okay, but that's just Bermuda.
This is the first really extended vacation, just the two of us. Because, we have kids,
Exactly.
You
want to
take your kids, and you want to give them the experience. But, this is like a second honeymoon kind of trip.
Damn kids.
Meddling kids, Bob. Meddling kids.
And, of course, the whole time we're there, it's like, we got to bring the kids back and show them all this cool stuff,
I wish the kids were here.
You did not.
We didn't say we wish they were there. We said we got to bring them back. Make a separate trip.
No, you're not going back. We're going to Japan.
These are not mutually exclusive.
Well, we got to get to Japan before it goes crazy over there.
All right, well, we got a great show for you this evening. We're going to start, Kara, with What's the Word?
Hey, that's me. This week, I thought I would do something differently. Mostly, I was inspired by listener Ryan Taylor, who wrote to us and said much earlier this year, I thought this would be a topic of interest. You've had conversations in the past about the history of specific phrases, like blood is thicker than water. You remember we went down that rabbit hole. And of course, I do What's the Word? This is in a similar vein. So he introduced the concept of fossil words. Have you guys heard of these before? I guess I hadn't heard that label, but I've thought about the concept.
Yeah, I haven't.
They're very old.
So fossil words are, as he put it, and this is pretty standard definition, words that have mostly disappeared from the English language but remain, quote, fossilized in several phrases. Like, we might talk about short shrift, but how often are you talking about shrift in another context?
Get the short shrift, right?
Yeah.
I love those,
Skullduggery.
Yes. And
one fell swoop.
One fell swoop, that's a great example. And there are a ton of them, like, without further ado or run amok. I rarely amok without running. How about you guys?
Right.
I just don't amok often.
Well, there's amok time.
I walk amok sometimes.
There are so many like this. I love this one. This one was fun as I was digging deep. Just desserts. It is DESERTS, spelled like deserts, but pronounced desserts like a deserter because it's the state of deserving something.
Oh, dessert.
Yes.
I thought maybe desertion.
No, so if you get your just desserts, you are getting something that you deserve. You're not getting, dessert, like chocolate cake. But right.
And that phrase is kind of a negative. It's kind of a negative term. Like somebody gets their just desserts.
Right, something
like,
that they deserve.
You got what you were asking for.
You got
for,
what you
right?
had coming.
You were asking yep. to be hurt.
Right? Here's one, kith and kin. You don't hear kith.
I know. I never hear
otherwise,
kith and kin, though. Is that a common one?
Well, you don't watch a Christmas Vacation movie. I watch that every year with Liz. But yeah, kith and kin.
I love the whole shebang. When's the last time anybody used shebang?
I say that every once in a while.
You do? Yeah, every.
Well, there has to be something, you know, big, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's got to fit it.
Well, and apparently programmers have taken it over and they use it in their languages as well.
If I remember correctly, Kara, Perry used to say that. He'd be like, the whole shebang. Like, you know, he'd say it like that. You know that, guys?
Yeah.
I feel like I see so many of these, and Steve, you may too, because I know Steve and I share our love for the New York Times crossword. Like, eke out is always on the crossword.
Yeah.
When is the last time you said eke otherwise?
Well, in terms of fear, it's a word for that denotes fear.
Yeah, it's spelled differently. Eke.
Spelled differently, yeah.
Mm-hmm. EKE is eke out.
What is, you're talking EKE.
Yeah, yep.
Really?
Yep, it's spelled
that
differently.
Eek?
Yeah, you eke something
out. What does
eke
mean?
EKE. Well, let's look it up. I mean,
like
that's
when
the
eke
thing.
Eke out a win,
like barely, just get by. Barely makes
barely.
Something.
Oh, I thought you meant what's the etymology of it. I was going to say, I couldn't get into the etymology of all of these things, but there are a fair amount, like beyond the pale is a perfect example. According to Merriam-Webster, it's not the word that we're used to using, like pale, like lacking in color. It was derived from a Latin word palus, which means stake. So beyond the pale was beyond the stakes or the fences that made up the boundaries. So it was outside of a boundary. That's where we got beyond the pale.
Okay.
It's not. It's a totally different word, pale. And then here's another
one. Makes sense, though.
Kidnap. So nap apparently was a slang word for nab. So if you nab something, they altered it like in the 17th century and said nap
it's like
instead. And the only way it's really stuck around is kidnapping. We don't use the word napping of anything else. It's different from the word nap to sleep. Totally different usage. Totally different word. Just spelled the same. And there's a few others like that. Slipshod, baited with bated breath. You only you only ever bait your breath, huh? You don't really bait anything else. It comes from the same root as abate. We use abate all the time.
Oh, sure, abatement.
We never use the word bait or baited.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just fascinating. And there are
in the offing.
In the offing.
Offing.
What's that?
That's just an expression that means like it's within possibility. Oh. You know, your raise is with, you know, is in the offing if you perform well.
That's so interesting. I've as I'm reading these lists, I'm only regurgitating the ones that feel salient to me, but there are so many that I'm like, I've never heard that in my, or maybe I've heard it and I've read it, but I've never said it. Like, do you ever say wend your way? Like wend one's way?
No, definitely not.
I never really
me
said
neither,
it.
But I see it all over all of these lists. Oh, here's another one. This one is, I think, relevant for a lot of skeptics. Slight, as in sleight of hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only time we use that word.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that weird?
But you can slight someone at the same time.
It's funny because I have noticed these fossils from time to time, but I never really realized how many there are.
A lot.
There's so many. Now, when you think about it, when you dive down this rabbit hole.
Oh, you stick something in one's craw?
Stuck in your craw.
Stuck in your craw. When else are you talking about craws?
Crawfish.
Or batten down the hatches?
That's legit, though. There are hatches that need battening.
Exactly.
Down
that's the only thing you batten, right?
It's really the only thing you batten. Yeah.
Do you batten up the hatch?
You might say board and batten when you're talking about a sail. But yeah, otherwise, that's it. You only batten a hatch.
Anchors away.
Fascinating. Anyway, so thank you once again to Ryan. That was really interesting to dive into. And now everybody will notice them, you know, when they are running amok, not walking amok. yeah. Oh, wreaking havoc. Haven't havoc without reek in a while. Haven't reeked without havoc either.
Reek havoc. Reek destruction. Yeah.
I'm gonna pay attention to come up with some more.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll try to inject as many as we can going forward.
Well, what you do is you find out what the pieces of it mean, and then you use that out of context.
Oh, yeah.
Appropriately, but out of the idiom.
Yeah, you use it in context, but out of the out of the fossilized phrase. Like, yeah.
there is a word I looked up specifically for my news item. So a little foreshadowing there, which is a rarely used word, and when you hear it, you'll probably know it.
Well, here's one that I think we could all probably use, like ulterior. Yes, it is still kind of in common parlance, but you only ever hear it when you're talking about ulterior motives. So maybe we can all use it to describe other intentionally kind of hidden things. Ulterior, I don't know.
Ulterior.
We're just going to come up with a bunch of synonyms for motive.
Well, it's got ulterior reasons. Our brains are so trained to hear motive after ulterior. Yeah. Now you have to decouple it from that. It's not natural.
Fascinating.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Weird. Mm-hmm. Jay, tell us about this new super material.
Well, slow down there.
Okay. Is it kryptonite?
It's cool. It's cool, but there's a lot to talk about. Well, first of all, you know, we have to talk about plastic in general real quick to kind of set the stage here. So as you guys know, right, plastic is unbelievably useful. It's used in all applications at this point. I mean, where isn't it used? We just can't live in the modern world without using it. It's cheap to produce. It's chemically stable. You know, it's useful in pretty much every industry. But the problem with plastic is what? That it doesn't biodegrade or does it incredibly slowly. It pollutes the environment. You know, it's like I was saying, this is not biodegradable stuff. It just stays there and it leaches chemicals into whatever surrounding area that it's in. You know, major concern here, the amount of plastic in the world is this freaking blows my mind. It's larger than the volume of Mount Everest. The used plastic in the world would bury Manhattan under 1.5 kilometers of plastic, which if you think about the sheer volume that we have in our environment, it's unreal. You know, we have research now that shows that it harms our ecosystems. It's entered the food chain. The recycling rates are just abysmal. They are so low, it's pathetic. And, you know, current global efforts are simply nowhere. There's nothing going on here that's going to regain the ground that plastic is taking from us every year. So, of course, lots of companies and research labs, you know, there's a huge effort to replace plastic with a material that has, you know, most of, if not all, the benefits of current plastic, but none of the negatives. And it's been impossible to do so far. So, for example, like past attempts that have been made, you know, they could come up with a material that would work, but it's way too expensive to make. It's not strong enough. It requires really complicated chemical processing, which, you know, the chemicals are expensive. Some of them could be very dangerous. However, there is, you know, of course, I'm going to pivot this to some research that's happened that has shown, you know, something promising that I think is worth talking about. So Rice University and the University of Houston, They might have developed something that could one day help us move away from the plastics that we use today. So their research was recently published in Cell Reports Physical Science. This is a journal. And they outlined the process for creating a very strong biodegradable material from bacterial cellulose. This is unlike most plastic substitutes. This one, you know, actually performs better than many of the metals and glasses that are being used in manufacturing, both in strength and thermal performance. Now, Steve, I know there's different kinds of strength. Mm-hmm. I think in general, for the applications that they could make with this, it would be, you know, stronger than the plastics that we're currently using. So they have some key innovations here. Cellulose is already the most abundant natural polymer on Earth. It's everywhere. It's, you know, it doesn't cost anything to get your hands on it. It's what gives plants their rigidity, right? So when you have a, you know, plant stalk that's standing up, you know, out of the ground, it's using cellulose to you know, have that form, to hold it in that form. But there's a bacteria now that the name is so ridiculous, I don't even know if I should try to say it. I'll try it. Ready, Kara? Just be patient with me here.
Okay.
It ends with an I, I'll bet.
It's Comagotiobacter xylanus.
Oh, I was right.
Comagotiobacter xylanus.
That's probably kind of right.
Yeah, close, right?
That sounds good.
In order to produce this, they spin cellulose into ultra-thin nanofibers. And these are long chains of glucose that form dense, entangled mats. And that's basically how plants make it, right? It grows that way. And it's not uniform. There's no rhyme or reason to how these strands like connect to each other. It's all chaotic. you know, you could just think of them as randomly aligned, right? All these different strands that are going in all different directions. Now, they're strong, but they're not remarkable in any way. So the Rice-Houston team changed that by introducing this interesting mechanical constraint. What they did was they grew the bacterial cellulose on a rotating gel in a bioreactor, right? So just think of it as like a flat plane that's spinning around inside of a bioreactor, and that's the environment that they grew the cellulose in. And this rotation forced the bacteria to lay down cellulose nanofibers in the direction that they wanted them to for it to grow in. And this formed ordered sheets rather than chaotic tangles. So that shape and that way that they connect with each other is uniform, and it fixes lots of problems. So the result is a highly aligned cellulose film that has a tensile strength up to 436 megapascals. So that doesn't mean anything unless, you know, let me give you a comparison for most of us who don't really know what that means. 436 megapascals in comparison. So a common plastics like PET plastics, we use those in water bottles, food containers, synthetic fabrics, right? They have a tensile strength of 50 to 100 MPa or megapascals. So aluminum tops out like at 400, and even some types of glass fall short of where the engineered cellulose could get to from a strength perspective, which is really cool because, of course, we want it to be strong. And as an added bonus, Steve, because you're purchasing today, no, but as the team said, as a bonus, right, you know, they didn't even know this was going to happen, but they found that if they essentially doped the films that the cellulose is being grown on or laid down onto, these films have boron nitride nanosheets, right, that are there during the biosynthesis. Now these are atom thin structures, and they're known for high thermal conductivity and strength, and they bond to the cellulose and they make a matrix. And what this does is it's like a film with a tensile strength now up to 553 megapascals, which is even stronger. Right?
Pascals.
Yes, exactly. Isn't there a guy named Pascal?
Yeah.
Right. Was.
I will never say that incorrectly again. So this now is more than five times stronger than the PET plastics like water bottles and food containers. It's three times better at dissipating heat compared to the untreated cellulose. And all this is happening without needing high temperatures or chemical solvents or any expensive post-processing. The bacteria essentially build the material in one step. Now, of course, this sounds so good, right? You know, there are some takeaways that we're going to get to. But, you know, before I go there, this would have potentially broad applications. You know, you could use this material in thermal management for electronics, which, you know, if you think about how much thermal management is happening in all these heat-producing electronics that we all have, I mean, each one of us probably owns, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 devices alone in the house. That turns into a lot of need for thermal management. Mm-hmm. They could use it for packaging films, biodegradable textiles, flexible sensors. It happens to be optically transparent. It's foldable. Like I said, it's strong, and it's more thermally efficient than conventional plastic. So it contains no toxic byproducts. There's one called bisphenol A, BPA, right? BPA.
Mm-hmm.
That's not present in this. And unlike petroleum-based polymers, it will naturally mm-hmm. degrade.
And that's important.
And doesn't introduce anything funky into the environment. So, you know, this isn't just lab tinkering. Like they're not just like, hey, lab scale tinkering where they make a tiny little bit of this stuff, but it would cost an incredible amount to mass produce it. The process can be scaled up using the rotating gel platforms in standard bioreactors. It makes it far more viable than most of the other green materials that other companies have come up with. Most of them, if not all of them, couldn't get out of the small scale production, and they're not seeing a problem here with that. So this is the first time that bacterial cellulose outperformed plastics and metals across multiple categories, again, without requiring exotic methods or expensive inputs. So I did try to specifically find out like what this is on track for. So, you know, they have to do all the things that need to be done in order to get past the initial gates, right? They have to prove that it can be scaled up to a, you know, very, very large amount, right? It's not just, you know, hey, we want to make enough, you know, we want to make a pound of this stuff a day. They probably, you know, are looking way past that, like for mass production. They need to find out you know, how cost effective it'll eventually be. I read that there are steps along the way where it could be like, you know, there some early uses of it could come out as soon as like 2 to 3 years. But for it to go into like full production and really be replacing a lot of the products that we use, it's probably, and I hate to say it,
five to 10 years.
You know, that's the, you know, it, we've said this before, but the 5 to 10 year thing means they don't know how long it's going to take.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It could be less than that, depending on how well the research goes and everything. You know, this isn't like testing, you know, medical procedures or medical interventions on people where there's, you know, an incredible amount of testing that has to be done. They could get to the finish line in a few years if things go really well with, you know, how well the testing goes. And, you know, as they scale it up, it's there's nothing holding it back. I'm being hopeful because I want to think that my kids have the chance of living in a future that isn't completely choked out by the plastics that we're making. You know, I think about this all the time, like on a personal level, like I don't buy plastics if it's possible. You know, if I'm in the supermarket, if I can find ketchup in a glass container, I'm going to do that. It's not easy. And most of the time, you know, I can't do it, but you can find some products that are in glass containers, you know, switch brands if you have to, whatever. We all need to stop.
Or aluminum. It's fine.
Exactly. I love it when a water bottle, like you want to buy water and it comes in a big aluminum can. I love that.
But my big question, Jay, is how much will it cost? Is it cost effective?
Yeah, that's I think the big one.
Yeah.
If
that could be a deal killer.
Of course it could, you know, but if the price is a little bit more expensive, you know, I think it would be fine. I mean, if it's like 10 times the price, you know, we don't know anything yet, but I'm going to keep an eye on it. You know, this is on my list of things I'm looking at. I really do hope that this works. I mean, imagine that. We just dump all this stuff in a landfill when we're done with it, and it just biodegrades and goes away, and it's totally fine.
Jay, you should look for catsup. I think that comes in a glass jar.
I will do that immediately.
Instead of the ketchup.
All right. Thanks, Jay. You guys remember who Avi Loeb is, right?
Oh, yeah.
Avi Loeb.
Oh, how's he been? What's he chasing now?
He is the Harvard astrophysicist whose claim to fame came when he speculated that the first interstellar object that was detected, Oumuamua, might be actually an alien probe.
Yeah. Uh-huh. A spaceship, if you will.
Right. So remember a couple weeks ago we talked about the third interstellar object, the Three-Eyed
Atlas?
Yes, I did.
It was a wonderful news segment.
It was very well delivered.
Thoroughly researched.
Thoroughly researched. You know, Avi Loeb published a paper and then wrote, you know, an opinion piece saying that we need to investigate whether this is an alien artifact.
Okay.
And, you know, he has the Galileo project, which is dedicated to looking for techno signatures, you know, of alien technological civilizations.
And that's a worthwhile endeavor.
Absolutely.
I think that's how we're going to find them. You know?
I thought that may be the most likely way that we're going to detect the existence of alien civilizations is through their techno signatures. I agree. My problem with him is not that he's doing that. It's that he's doing it wrong. He's just not doing a good job. I mean, he is, in my opinion, falling into this pattern that we have encountered many times of a scientist who is not familiar with pseudoscience, who then falls into all of the pseudoscientific pitfalls and traps.
Yeah.
Right? We've talked about this occasionally over the years on the show. Like, remember there was that neurologist who fell for facilitated communication. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing. It's like you don't knowing science, even being a, you know, world-class scientist at an institution like Harvard is not protection from falling for pseudoscience if you are not familiar with all the critical thinking stuff that goes into understanding pseudoscience. Remember Mack, who also was at Harvard?
John Mack.
Yeah, John Mack, mm-hmm. the psychiatrist who thought his patients
alien
were actually abducted by aliens. I mean, you know, come on. Anyway, so here are some of his arguments. They're so bad. They are so, they're like embarrassingly bad.
They are.
But he outlines his arguments. One is that,
well,
Three-Eye Atlas, you know, again, it's an interstellar comet. It's zipping through our solar system. It's going too fast to be bound by the gravitational, you know, pull of the sun. So it's, you know, on a hyperbolic pathway. So we know from its path that it came from out of the solar system and will leave our solar system. So, and it's the third interstellar object that like that that we have detected. So he has done what we call anomaly hunting, right? Oh, let's just look for features and then invent some reason why this might be an indication that it's an alien artifact.
Yeah, especially if you have a preconceived notion about things and try to retrofit it.
Yeah, like he's starting with, the, like, let's look for things that might indicate that it's alien, right? So one thing he says is the orbital plane of the comet of 3I Atlas is about 5 degrees off the ecliptic, which is, you know, pretty close to the ecliptic. And he says there's a 0.2% chance that that would be the case, that it would be 5 degrees and it would be in retrograde compared to the planets, the direction that the planets are going. So, but okay, so what? You know, why would the, you know, the plane of the comet be in any way predictive that this might be alien?
Right. Would we even notice any that were not in the plane?
Well, so he is assuming the 0.2% comes from, you know, any possible random arrange, you know,
right,
orbital plane. So I looked into that because I know what you're saying, Bob. Like, what if we're looking for them more in the plane? But Atlas is a whole sky survey.
Ah.
So I'm assuming that since it's a whole sky survey, that it does have an equal chance of noticing things in any plane. So that's fine. My real problem with, I mean, first of all, if you're just going by the 5 degrees, it's actually 2.7%, right? 10 degrees, 5 degrees on either side of the ecliptic out of 360. But he includes the fact that it's retrograde. But again, he retrofits. Mm-hmm. It's like the sharpshooter fallacy. You know, he's drawing the bullseye around the hole. So he says because it would make it harder for Earth, for observers from Earth to detect it.
Oh.
And therefore to intercept it with chemical rockets.
That's
interesting. Oh my God. Like, so they know
that
chemical
we are
rockets.
Here. Exactly. Yeah, they know all about us.
That's one problem with that. The other, I mean, it's also that's a secondary problem.
That's why it's laughable.
The primary problem is like, so what? You know, you could have invented some reason why an alien might desire any possible feature, you know, parameter of this comet. This is not something that you could predict ahead of time. Again, you're just completely retrofitting. But yeah, there is this deeper problem of, and connects to another point that he makes. This is like, I think, his worst point. He says, at the speed it's going, it would have entered our solar system 8,000 years ago. And he says,
Wait, do we know enough of its orbit?
That's what he says.
So this was roughly when human-made technologies became advanced enough to start documenting history on Earth.
Oh, here we go.
Again, frick what? So, well, I mean, he's saying that the aliens knew that we were interesting at that point, right? So then they sent the probe to take a look at us. But it makes no sense at all when you think about it. So first of all, why are you starting your count at the beginning of our solar system? Where did the probe come from?
Right. Outside the solar system.
Yeah, but we don't know where.
Right.
You know, that's completely arbitrary to say that's when it was the aliens decided to send a probe our way. And also because that's when we started to document our history. So what? That's not when civilization became apparent or crossed some threshold. Again, talk about searching for any justification, right? There's nothing special about 8,000 years ago. But
that's such motivated reasoning.
Yeah, totally. But Bob, then you relate that to the, well, they sent, so he makes another point that it will get it to its close approach to the sun when it's on the opposite side of the sun from the Earth, right? So it's perihelion will be hidden from observer on the Earth. That because that would be the best time for it to fire its rockets to change its orbit to stay in the solar system, and observers from Earth wouldn't be able to see it.
We can't see it. No evidence.
It's, well, again, it's just, it's astrology level retrofitting. It's like, so it's making so many assumptions about the motivations of the aliens, these alleged aliens who were sending in their probes. But first of all, think about this. So if he's arguing 8,000 years ago, the aliens decided we want to take a look at that planet, and then they orchestrated this orbit so that, you know, 8,000 years ago, so that it will be in the plane of the ecliptic, so we could it could like send probes or take a look at multiple planets, you know, on its way in, but be hard to detect for an astronomer on Earth, and also make maneuvers on the opposite side of the sun, hidden from Earth. So that assumes that we're at a particular place in technology 8,000 years in the future.
Yep.
And not only that, but that particular...
Impossible to
predict, but it's essentially where we are right now, which is chemical rockets, which is probably just a tiniest little blip on our technological time scale, right? First of all, we could have fission rockets right now.
We had them in the 60s. We were testing them. I mean,
I know, it's like technologically,
it's just a quirk of history why we don't.
It's a quirk of history. It's not a foregone conclusion that there's going to be any prolonged period where we only have chemical rockets.
Also, Steve, if that thing's trying to hide its trajectory change on the far side of the sun, we could still detect something happened. Like, wait a second. That new trajectory makes no sense.
Well, I know.
What happened?
We would immediately know something happened. And he said, because that way it could come and then visit the Earth. It's like, then why hide itself from us if it's if it's going to come visit the Earth anyway?
Steve, you're not a Harvard astronomer. Let's face it, okay? You don't understand.
It's almost childish. I'm like, come on. That's your reasoning? It is such anomaly hunting and special pleading, and it's just bad. So, again, aspect of it is that it gives a bad name to academic disciplines searching for technosignatures, because I think that's a legitimate endeavor. But when you have like the face of that be somebody who's doing it so poorly and making arguments that are so transparently nonsensical, it actually accomplishing, I think, the thing that he's most afraid of, right? So if you read his article, he's very defensive about sort of the academic and scholarly legitimacy of what he's doing.
Oh, he's gotten lots of pushback.
Yeah, for good reason, but he's missing the point.
Yeah.
He's saying we need to keep an open mind, and it would, you know,
oh,
like he's
that's not an open
yeah,
mind.
It has nothing to do with the things he's talking about. It has nothing to do with this isn't a legitimate academic concern or having
an
open mind.
Open,
it has to do with your arguments
are crap,
dude. That's what it has to do with. Only that. Your logic is crap. And I think a lot, you know, so he needs some 101 in critical thinking and pseudoscience so that he does not fall into
podcast.
These blatant pitfalls.
Read our book.
Read our book.
Start there. You could start there, absolutely.
And then become a listener.
So frustrating. And then, you know, he finishes off up by jacking off, right? Just asking questions, kind of approach. He's like, he says,
that is a hilarious expression. J-A-Q-ing off. I love it. Just
this is how questions. We finish. This is towards the end. Our paper is largely a pedagogical exercise with interesting realizations worthy of a record in the scientific literature. By far, the most likely outcome will be that 3I Atlas is a completely natural interstellar object, probably a comet, and we await the astronomical data to support this likely origin. Nevertheless, when viewed from an open-minded and unprejudiced perspective, our paper includes many compelling insights that could be applied to tens of interstellar objects that are expected to be detected over the next decade by the Vera C. Rubin Observatory. No, it doesn't. It doesn't include compelling insights. It includes horrible logic and terrible arguments. And that's the problem. But you can see how defensive he's being, trying to like justify what he's doing.
That actually would have been cool if he came up with a list. You know, if he said, now, Atlas, I'm sure it's a comet, but here's things that we could look for in the future that could be interesting and informative and somewhat anomalous and really come up with real things to look for.
Actual anomalies and something that might have some predictive value. Now, the problem with the predictive value thing is that we don't have any...
You have to wait millennia.
We don't have any gold standard, right? We don't know how to judge how predictive any feature is because we have nothing to compare it to. We can't say we've seen this before and these are features that we can statistically correlate with interstellar objects being an alien artifact, being a natural phenomenon. And we're just speculating. Again, he's just speculating very, very poorly. I think that he almost admits by saying that it's overwhelmingly likely to be a natural object, he's admitting that all of his things together have almost no predictive value. I think, though, he thinks it has a small predictive value, whereas I think it has zero predictive value. It has zero predictive value because the methods he's using are so bad, because he's anomaly hunting and retrofitting and special pleading. The fact that he also, you know, now runs an organization that gets donations to do this, you know, you could make of that what you will.
At least he's consistent.
That's not, it's not a good thing, though, when you're consistently bad. That's not a good thing. He clearly has learned nothing over the last 7 years after his Oumuamua experience.
Yeah. It reminds me of Ralph Cramden. Ralph Cramden, you know, screws up. Remember the Honeymooners? He screws up again, and he says to his wife, "Alice, no one's 100%. You know, no one's 100%. And his wife's like, "You are. You get it wrong every time."
No learning curve that I can detect. All right. Anyway, Bob, tell us about this belly fat jab.
All right. Fat in the news. Fat in the news. Taiwan's Callaway Pharmaceuticals announced a first-in-class injectable drug that appears to safely remove fat cells near the injection site. Not just shrinks them. They're gone. So this their study is based on their phase 2 results, which were recently published in the Aesthetic Surgery Journal. The paper's name is "Efficacy and Safety of CBL-514 Injection in Reducing Abdominal Subcutaneous Fat." Blah blah blah. I don't know about you guys, but Kara and I are very excited about this.
Yeah, we've been talking offline about this.
Right. This is like I send every week. I send here's my news item, some physics or astronomy thing. No word for a decade from Kara. I do this, and she's like, "Bob, oh my god, let's get on this study."
I know, it's like Kybella, but way better. I'm so excited.
Yeah, you guys don't know.
All right. So why are we excited? Do I even need to answer that?
Really,
I mean, we're human, first of all, right? Most humans are obsessed with this. The global weight loss industry is projected in 2034 to be about a third of $1 trillion, $360 billion by USD. So why is this big? I don't know. I have some notes here that I don't want to go on a rant, but losing weight or fat is a pain in the ass, right? It's hard. People are obsessed with it because it's hard. And of course, you got to factor in the media, right? Always throwing in our faces. You know, you got to be skinny and muscular. That's all that matters. So it has made people into these like machines looking for ways to lose fat, to lose weight, right? Temporary diets are horrible, right? Because they're statistically almost certain to fail in the long run. Right, restricting calories is really hard, and trust me, when you get a little older, it's like ridiculously hard. My body's like, "No, you're going to eat right now. You're not going to get hungry. I don't want you to get hungry." It's like I can't allow myself to get hungrier than usual. It's just a weird thing. I don't know if you guys are experiencing that too.
It's also, I feel like as I get older, my calorie deficits have to be more extreme because my metabolism is not what it was when I was young. Like when I was young, I could get away with eating a lot of calories and I was more active, but it feels like even now when I'm pretty active, my just basal metabolic rate is so much lower than it was before. It's just hard to get rid of it. And I like that you were saying fat and not weight, because it's not really about losing weight, right? It's about losing, especially belly fat.
Yeah, the dangerous stuff. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and this is why Ozempic is so popular now. It's as popular as, I was trying to think of an analogy, as Coke in the 70s, right? It's just a weekly injection, and you almost certainly are going to lose weight. But even with Ozempic and similar GLP-1 drugs, they're problematic. And we talked about it on the show a bit. They cause both fat and muscle loss. And muscle is, you know, notoriously difficult to build. And it's among our most precious tissues. And losing that is actually, it's horrible because, you know, you lose
you lose fat and muscle, then you gain fat back. So you're actually worse off. It'd be better if you didn't lose any weight at all, because you end up with even less muscle. So Ozempic also is good in a lot of ways, but also bad because you're losing some muscle as well. So this new drug also has the added benefit of not only killing fat cells, which is you know, a lot better than just shrinking them, because when a fat cell goes away, it's gone. You're not going to be building new fat cells, especially after adolescence. It just really doesn't happen. So this drug, you lose the fat cells die only near where it's injected. So let's talk about the drug more specifically. It's called CBL-514. It's a small molecule drug, and it triggers something called adipocyte apoptosis, fat cell death. This is programmed cell death. It uses chemical triggers to do that. It's a natural process. Any debris, any dead cells are cleaned up by our immune systems and metabolized into energy or harmless waste products. So this is a natural thing that's not dramatic, that doesn't impact other critical systems of your body at all. And there's three possible uses for this drug. There's the non-surgical fat reduction, which I've been mainly focusing on, but also cellulite. And this would help with that. And there's also a disease called Durkheim's disease. Hadn't heard about that one. That's apparently a condition that causes painful fatty tumors to build up around the body. This sounds like this would be perfect for that. Just, you know, killing those fat cells that are causing the pain. This sounds like a great application for that. So, okay, this new study is specifically about how this drug did in its phase 2 trials. We've mentioned phases like this probably scores of times on the show. Phase 1 is essentially a small group of people, 20 to 100. It's, you know, it's first time, and it's essentially for evaluation of safety and dosage range and if there's any, you know, obvious side effects. That's a phase 1. Phase 2, as we're seeing here, expands this study to a large group, 100 people to 300 people, and then to see how effective it is and to further evaluate its safety. Phase 3 then, which could come after this, could involve hundreds to thousands of participants.
Sign me up.
Yeah. So there is actually, I did find one drug that is similar to this. It was an injectable drug that could get rid of fat in very small areas where it's injected. It's called ATX-101. It stands for deoxycholic acid injection.
Is that, that's Kybella, right? Yeah, that's what I was mentioning before. Kybella seems to be the only thing on the market. But it's like an acid that injects and kills the fat cells with acid. It doesn't actually induce apoptosis.
Well, yeah, that sounds nasty. Yeah. Currently, though, that is the only FDA-approved, minimally invasive, injectable treatment for fat reduction. And it has been effective for small areas, but the side effects are scary. We're talking about skin necrosis, dead skin, ulceration, nerve injury, and infection. So no, thank you. I won't be going anywhere near that. That sounds pretty nasty.
Yeah, and it's mostly not used for belly fat. It's mostly used for double chin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So now CBL-514 has no side effects like that have been detected. What they did see was the following. So they had a phase 2A study. So this is a preliminary phase 2. It was mostly proof of concept at this point. The paper says that the drug had a favorable and acceptable safety profile as well as efficacy in reducing subcutaneous abdominal fat at multiple dose levels. So they show that this thing works and there was no obvious side effects. So now the meat of the paper, though, goes into the phase 2B trials, and there was two of those. So there's two papers, one for each of the phase 2B trials, which looked more again at efficacy and safety information. Now, the first phase 2B trial was randomized, single blind, and placebo controlled. It had 76 participants, and 80% showed a greater than or equal to 1 grade AFRS improvement. AFRS stands for Abdominal Fat Rating Scale, which is didn't know that thing existed. One article described it as 5 categories of abdominal fat rating. So they improved one of those. And I'll give a little more detail a little later. The second phase 2B study was double masked, placebo controlled, and it was multi-center, U.S. and Canada, and that had 173 participants. So for both of these, the researchers found that the safety profile was very favorable. It was consistently acceptable across both trials. No serious systemic side effects. The worst that was a local injection, swelling, and pain. Almost everyone, I think 99%, did note that there was some swelling and pain. Some people had a little bit more pain than others, but that was really the only thing that I came across in the two papers. In the paper's conclusion, they said, our results indicate that targeted injection consistently and significantly reduces subcutaneous abdominal fat, comparable to that achieved by liposuction, and shows a favorable safety profile. Over 75% of the CBL-514 treated participants who achieved the target fat volume loss greater than or equal to 150 milliliters required just one or two treatments. So it worked for the vast majority of the people, 75 to 80%. I believe there was some loss for, it seems, I think, for everyone, but 75 to 80% reached the target, which was 150 milliliters. So they're also, the other number that they throw around is like 20, the second test here, the second study used MRIs specifically to really take a close look at the fat. And there was like 20 to 25% of the fat layer was gone, something like that. So pretty dramatic, pretty solid. So it's also, I think it's important to emphasize that this isn't just for aesthetics. There are reasons to do this. That are more than just, you know, how you look and how you feel about yourself. Like I said, that there's also, this works for cellulite and Durkheim's disease, but the focus is on this non-surgical fat reduction. So it's more than aesthetic. The benefits are much broader. Abdominal fat, especially as we age, is related to serious conditions, including this chronic pain, this stroke, cardiovascular disease. Even though the drug targets just the subcutaneous fat just under the skin, it does not specifically target the deeper visceral fat, which is critical as well, because it's that fat that's kind of, you know, enmeshed around your internal organs. It's that fat that is why men have much more heart disease than women, because we have much more visceral fat.
How quickly does it work? Like, is it kill the fat cells like within minutes or what is
no,
it?
No, I think within a week or two. It's on a scale of weeks when it's you know, they were going back and testing them to make sure to see how much they had lost. So yeah, it's fairly quick, a week or so.
And you were saying it doesn't touch visceral fat.
No, it doesn't. But that said, they said that it seems like it could have a positive impact on the hard to treat visceral fat, but they need more research on that. So there may be a little bit of a benefit to the visceral fat, but you know, the effect doesn't go too much farther from the injection site. So if you're just injecting it, you know, into your belly, you know, the visceral fat's farther away. So it's going to be, you know, it's not necessarily going to have a direct impact. So it seems to be maybe a little bit of an impact, but I think that they need more research for that.
But if you're already reducing your total fat store load,
yes,
then the work that you're doing may have a greater benefit on visceral fat.
Yeah.
Like if you are doing calorie deficit or you are increasing your
Absolutely.
Your energy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even just reducing the subcutaneous fat can still reduce chronic disease risk, at least. So there definitely could be some very good benefits to getting rid of this fat. All right, so the next step here is phase three, which has already started. They're planning on over 300 participants across 30 clinical sites in U.S. and Canada. If Canada even still wants to work with us at this point, we shall see what happens. So based on the clear results of these phase two studies and the extensive preliminary work that they've already done with the FDA for phase three, there is hope that this drug could be commercially available sooner than what may be typical. One of the articles I read by Bronwyn Thompson at newatlas.com claimed that this drug could potentially be commercially available in 12 months. That seems overly optimistic. And Steve, I know you agree with that. That's probably overly optimistic, but it could potentially be much sooner. I don't think this is going to be a 5-year, 10-year thing at all. It could be, you know, maybe a couple of years or maybe even sooner. I don't know. But they're definitely into phase three at this point. And if this gets cleared and everything looks good after phase three, then there's nothing really that's going to stop this. And I think if this goes well, if this goes very well, this is just going to explode. I don't know what the cost would be, but I think this could be Ozempic level, like, frenzy of people trying to get their hands on spot reduction of fat with just some swelling and pain in the injection site. To me, that's just like people are going to be clamoring for this.
Bob, do you think that this is going to cost a ton of money or what?
Yeah, I don't know. Hard to say.
I don't think so. I mean, it's only single. It's effective after a single or two injections.
Yeah, one or two injections.
So even if they are really expensive, it's not going to be like Ozempic. You have to keep taking.
Yeah, That's weekly for for a bunch of weeks.
Kind of like forever. I think that the people who go off of it gain the weight back.
Yeah, they get.
The devil's in the details, right? So, like, if they give you a single injection, and you know it has a certain amount of biomass it's going to get rid of, right?
Yeah, those cells are gone. So even if you lose weight, if you gain weight back, you're gaining the weight with fewer fat cells. So it's just not going to be the same. You know, it's not going to be the same.
Yeah, you'd have to make whole new fat cells, and you'd have to replace them.
Right, but that doesn't happen after. There's like three times in your life where you actually create fat cells. The last time that happens, you know, like when you're born is one, and also adolescence is another one. So when you're an adult, you're pretty much done making fat cells, you know, from scratch.
Really?
So if you get rid of fat cells,
I like that.
Then they are gone. Your body's really not going to create any new ones. And the reason why you have areas of your body, like compare your stomach to your bicep. The amount of fat cells in your per unit area of your bicep under your skin is far fewer fat cells there than in your stomach. Under your abdomen. There's lots of fat cells there. That's why it gets bigger quicker than any other place in your body, because there's more fat cells there. If you remove those fat cells, that's just, you know, it's not going to be a problem area nearly as much as it used to be with so many fat cells. It's just, they're not there.
Yeah, but to be clear, though, you still will gain weight.
Oh,
you'll still store fat. But the distribution of that fat storage will be altered by the fact that you have artificially eliminated fat cells from one part of your body.
So problem areas will be less problematic is another way to put it.
Yeah, you might develop new problem areas, though, that are even worse than the one that you just got rid of.
Well, I can see this being purely, you said there were some kind of like diseases that this could tackle. But for the most part, this is going to be a cosmetic development that is targeted towards individuals who are a relatively healthy weight or have mild, like, or who are somewhat overweight.
Yeah, and not morbidly obese.
Yeah, and who are just struggling with, like, basically with confidence about their bodies.
Right.
Thanks, Bob. Kara, tell us the latest news about hormone therapy.
Yeah, not just hormone therapy. There's actually two things I wanted to cover today that are sort of, I guess, process stories. There are two FDA panels that convened recently. Both of them were, because they were introduced at least by Dr. Marty McCarry, who is the new FDA commissioner under the current administration. And I'm feeling a certain kind of way, like I'm being pulled in two different directions. So I'm going to be really curious about the insights of the team here. So the first one, actually, I'm going to go away from hormones and come back to them in a minute, has to do with antidepressants during pregnancy. So for a very long time, a lot of research has gone into determining the safety and efficacy of basic antidepressants, like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. The article in the New York Times that covered this panel focuses on Prozac. Prozac kind of came on the scene about four decades ago. That's fluoxetine. That happens to be the antidepressant that I take. And a lot of research has gone into determining its safety and its efficacy during pregnant. And although there are some potential side effects and there's some risks, low-level risks, a slight rise in the odds of birth defects, time and time again, it does appear to be the case that the risk of a mother having untreated depression during her pregnancy outweighs the minor risk of an increased odds in birth defects. Yet, as we know, the Department of Health and Human Services is led by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who oversees the Food and Drug Administration, specifically the FDA, as I mentioned before. The commissioner is Dr. Marty McCarry. I've read up on Marty McCarry. Interesting guy, seems to have a lot of legitimacy to his training, to his active work as a pancreatic surgeon, specifically doing surgical oncology. He trained at Johns Hopkins. He was involved, I think, with Atul Gawande in the surgical checklist that was developed there at Johns Hopkins. But he was an advocate of universal masking during COVID, but he has opposed broad vaccine mandates, and he has had some kind of concerning views about vaccines. At the same time, like, it's hard to pin down whether his decision making has been political. He donated to Obama's presidential campaign, but he's also been an advisor to a conservative healthcare think tank. So I think that I'm hoping at least that he is a person, until we're proven otherwise, that is making decisions, or at least personal decisions and policy decisions, where there is no, I guess, pressure put on him based on the evidence and based on his clinical thoughts and feelings. That said, we don't know. He is starting to see, it's starting to seem like there's a shift in his conversations about things like food dyes and things like that. But let's take a step back and let's talk about these two panels that he ran. The first one is about the use of antidepressants during pregnancy and whether or not the FDA should actually add a black box label, which has never been there before. Many individuals who watched the panel and reported on the panel have stated that they felt that the panel was very biased and very anti-psychiatry, that many of the experts on the panel have backgrounds and agendas that seem to be anti-psychiatry. So we had, for example, somebody named Dr. Yosef Witt Doring, who is the founder of a tapering clinic that works to help patients quit psychiatric medications. He claimed that many women will come to him on antidepressants and he tries to help them get off because of the risks to a fetus. We also have two British psychiatrists on the panel that were invited by the FDA who have long records of criticizing the use of psychotropic medication, Dr. Joanna Moncrief and Dr. David Healy, who have written books about psychiatric medication and who have also served as expert witnesses on trials involving psychotropic drugs. But there was one panelist named Kay Roussos-Ross, who is an expert in postpartum health at the University in Florida, who actually made a case that, you know, antidepressants are really important in treating pregnant women, especially those who may use substances or forego prenatal care if they're not taking their antidepressants. And so there is some concern that this panel was convening as a politically motivated panel that is, I guess we could say, biased against psychiatric medications, and that the decision-making of the panel may not be evidence-based. Now, if we switch gears to another panel, and this is interesting and confusing to me, and I'm, again, curious about your take, but also the rest of the rogues. Another panel that recently convened is calling for the removal of black box warnings on certain hormone replacement therapies. Specifically, one of the things that they really focused on in this panel was the black box warning on topical estrogens. Now, the panelists stated that many of the black box warnings that come with menopausal hormone replacement treatments are based on findings of studies that were performed when HRT dosages were significantly higher than they are today. They were also based on studies that were performed where the average age was significantly older than the average age of those receiving HRT currently, because many people are starting hormone therapies while they're still in perimenopause, not when they're officially in menopause. And so there's kind of a double argument that was put forward in this panel. The first one was all of the risks, and we're talking about potential, blood clots, cardiac risks, and stroke that kind of led to the original black box warning label that was put on these hormonal menopause products, these HRTs, was again based on a higher dosage than women take right now. The other one is that it was all based on oral hormone, so systemic hormone, and not topical treatments like vaginal, like creams or ointments that are often used to counteract some of the symptoms of menopause, like vaginal dryness and painful sex. So it's an interesting argument that sort of gets to the heart, I think, of one of the important conversations that has to be had when it comes to biomedical science, which is that there's the research side of things, and then there's the regulatory side of things. And the hope is that those two things play nice and that they're in lockstep. But the reality is that very often there is either a delay or there's kind of a slowness to titrate, for lack of a better word, the way that we regulate these things. At the same time, there are some individuals, and I think Dr. Jen Gunter is cited in this article, and she's, a very prominent skeptic in the OBGYN space, saying, I am still really concerned about a lot of the side effects. We don't have enough evidence to show that they're not harmful. That said, she specifically kind of mentioned that the topical argument is one that she agrees with. It's just, it's disconcerting when we see experts across the field or across, and we talk about this all the time in our discussions of biomedical science here as skeptics, right? One of the things that we often talk about is consensus, right? That there are certain things that are sort of without a shadow of a doubt, the vast majority of experts have consensus on, and that's how science works, right? We look at the consensus of subject matter experts. Then there are other places where there may be finer points that are still up for debate. And those are really interesting edges that are important to dive into and to talk about and to try to promote and fund more thorough and creative efforts to do science in those areas. And then there are those places where it's sort of the sharpshooter fallacy, right? Where a decision has already been made due to a bias or an agenda that's being forwarded, and then the evidence is cherry-picked. And right now we're living in an era where there is so much evidence. There's just a lot of science, a lot of good science, but a whole lot of junk science. And it's very easy to cherry-pick and make what sounds like an intelligent argument for almost anything. And so it's worrisome that we're living in an era where science is deeply, deeply politicized. And so I'm curious, Steve, in your reading, especially of somebody like Dr. Marty McCary, and in your reading of like these two very different panels that were convened and run by similar people about both adding a black box warning label to something that in my view probably doesn't need it and removing a black box warning label to something that I don't know if I have enough background to know if it should be removed or just altered yet.
There are certain trends that I have noticed, right, over the last 30 years with these mm-hmm. kinds of expert panels and the FDA recommendations, et cetera, to keep in mind. So one trend is that there's a tendency to be risk averse, to right. be more worried about causing harm than missing out on a benefit. And sometimes the numbers don't favor that approach. Mm-hmm.
Especially if the harm is not death. Like if the harm is not death or dismemberment.
Whatever. Even if it is, it's a mm-hmm. numbers game, right?
True.
At the end of the day. So, even within my own specialty, I've seen drugs get a black box warning for a theoretical risk that yeah. wasn't even shown to be actually the case. And then 20 years later, people are still avoiding that, you know, use of a medication, even though, like, now we know there's no risk. Like, the risk is
negligible. Well, and that's what they talk about a lot in these write-ups, yeah, is the idea that this does change prescribing and it changes consumer uptake of these drugs. Like, and here's an example that I'll give you just to interject and then please continue. Yeah. I take a drug for a disorder called idiopathic hypersomnia that is massively black box. Like, it's got a black box warning and it's really regulated. Yeah. And it has a lot of really dangerous side effects and worrisome side effects. That said, it is the only drug on the market that's FDA approved for my diagnosis. Everything else that's given is off label. And there's even a drug that's somewhat off label that's now has orphan status for my diagnosis, because my diagnosis is very rare and it's debilitating. And the risk-benefit analysis is such that because I can tolerate this drug, my neurologist and I agree it's very much an important drug for me to take. On the flip side of that, if you guys remember on the show, I talked at length. I was very open about having gone through hysterectomy. After my hysterectomy, I couldn't take birth control anymore because I used vaginal birth control. And I had a lot of side effects from going off birth control that I didn't like. I had an explosion in acne. I didn't feel well. My hormones, like my moods were all over the place. And so as soon as I could, I got back on it. Then I had a blood clot. And now nobody will write me a prescription for the birth control, even though we know that my blood clot was caused by, like, it was caused by an iron infusion. Mm-hmm. And but nobody will come near it. Back in the day when I tried to get on it, they were like, oh, you have migraine with Aura. We're not going to prescribe it. And I remember really struggling with that. I remember my gynecologist saying, you can't take birth control because you have Aura. And then my neurologist saying, that's outdated data.
That's outdated, yeah.
Nobody takes birth control at the level they used to take. And now it's not a risk anymore. And so you see that different specialties are arguing. And then as the patient, you're stuck in the middle going, how do I get the help I need?
There is a specialty bias, and that's just familiarity with the literature. Because you know why? Because neurologists read the neurological literature, and internists read the internist literature, and they don't necessarily read each other's literature to the same degree, and that matters. Because there's a lot of drugs where neurologists have come to a comfort level with it, where like cardiologists are afraid to use it. And that you hit upon one was the hormone therapy in migraine with Aura. I reviewed that literature because I have to make those recommendations to my patients. Yeah. And it's like, it's not really a risk. It was always a minor theoretical, maybe, sort of, might be a risk. But then you can give the progesterone only. And really, it's only a risk if you also smoke. If you don't smoke, don't worry about it, basically.
Right.
And
there are such low-dose estrogen drugs now.
That's true. And also, you fail to consider the risk of not treating, because
I know
that has a risk as well. So so that's the risk aversion thing. I think there's a bias in there that you have to think about, and you may want to consult with multiple specialists on big decisions for that reason, get different perspectives. But the other thing is that even when you have well-meaning, evidence-based practitioners, there's not always an objective answer, because it is risk versus benefit.
Right.
And the question is, what is more meaningful to you, this risk or that risk, this benefit or that benefit? And there's no right or wrong answer. And people come to different conclusions about it. Like, I remember we had the same debate about how old should we start recommending routine mammograms.
Mm-hmm.
And two different panels came up with two different age cutoffs, and it was based upon how much of a risk do you think is the anxiety caused by a false positive?
Yeah, I was going to say, a big part of this is a conversation about psychological health, which I don't think historically was considered as much. And the truth of the matter is, a black box warning carries weight psychologically.
It does.
And it's very because all drugs have a package insert, right? All drugs are legally required to list the risks and the side effects. At what point does it cross a threshold to require a black box warning? And how much of that is up for debate? I don't know. I mean, I think that is an important categorical question.
There's also a medical legal issue here. It's like there's a one question is, what do you think is probably the best medical decision? But there's also the question of what is the decision you're confident you could defend in a court of law?
Yeah, those aren't always the same thing.
And black box warnings are like a don't go there kind of thing. It's like doctors worry about that.
Yeah, it's like do it at your own risk. Yeah. But I remember asking my neurologist. I was like, listen, is there long term data about this drug that I take, that's only been on the market for a few years, taking it nightly? And he was like, not really. Like, we don't, so far it seems like people are okay, but we don't have longitudinal long-term data. And I was like, should I be scared of that? And he was like, well, you know what we do have is longitudinal long-term data of what happens when you sleep 12 to 14 hours a day, and it's not good.
Right.
So it's like at a certain point, that sort of risk versus benefit, you're right. We bias towards risk aversion without remembering that the do nothing approach comes with its own risks.
Doing nothing is a risk. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But the social media TikTok universe is all about risk. No nuance. There's no risk versus benefit. Mm-hmm. This is the RFK approach. It's all about he's taking a lawyer. What risk can I, you know, can I scare people about approach to healthcare? It's destructive. It's actively harmful. It's not really logic and evidence based. And so that's
why I'm so curious and confused about these specific panels, because one is about adding a black box label to something that does seem to have a political agenda behind it. But another is about removing a black box label to something that I guess historically RFK and McCary have been proponents of hormone therapy. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting, like, what is the motivation there? I don't know. More to dig into for sure.
Right. All right, thanks. Evan, this is a funny story that we have a personal connection to.
We do.
But give us an update. Tell us about the haunted doll.
Annabelle the Cursed Doll, back in the news. We covered one 5 years ago. 5 years. Mm-hmm. That was the last time we spoke about Annabelle. Remember, that's when COVID was raging. That's how long ago that was. I have dubbed Annabelle the second most well-recognized doll in the world.
Behind Chucky?
No. Second, Barbie.
Third.
Barbie
third.
Was number
Barbie.
Recognized. Barbie was number one. Chucky was number three. And Ken was number 14.
What about Kermit the Frog?
Didn't make the list.
Oh, well, come on.
You know.
It's not a doll.
Puppet doll.
It's a Muppet, man.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. Right. Well, in any case. And as Steve mentioned, we have seen, at least the guys have. Sorry, Carrie, you weren't with us at the time. But we saw Annabelle up and close. In fact, one of us, Bob, might have touched her.
No.
Or in the case. I mean, in the case it was.
Yeah, it was in the case. I couldn't get to Annabelle, unfortunately. But I'll never forget, what's his name? Demonologist dude.
Ed Warren?
Ed. Oh, mm-hmm. My God. It's like, don't touch anything because people have died who have touched because everything was so cursed. So I'm walking behind him and literally touching everything within reach.
In his
everything. In his 20 museum. Years ago, whatever it was, still alive. It's like, so ridiculous. Come on, don't touch anything.
But Bob, that might be why you can't lose the last 5 pounds.
It could be. That's the curse of Annabelle working.
There you go. There you go. Worth it. Totally worth it.
Annabelle is the name of a Raggedy Ann doll, which came into the possession of Ed and Lorraine Warren. The original Ghost Hunters, I don't know, did they start the genre? Can they be credited?
They gave
with
it a boost. I don't know if they were the first.
Yeah.
I mean, they go back a ways, though.
1952 is when they started with their shtick. Boy, I tell you what. Well, in any case, Annabelle, Raggedy Ann doll, according to the Warrens, back in 1970... there was a student nurse named Donna, no last name, and Donna was given the doll. Donna lived with her roommate, Angie, also no last name, and both soon noticed strange occurrences. The doll seemed to change positions on its own and move from one room to another room when no one was looking. And then things escalated from there. They allegedly found mysterious notes written on parchment paper which they didn't own. It wasn't their paper. And it would have notes that would read things like, help us. The doll reportedly even appeared to have blood-like red liquid on its hands and chest. So they decided to seek some answers. Donna and Angie consulted a psychic medium, who told them the spirit of a young girl named Annabelle Higgins had attached itself to the doll. The spirit said she felt safe with the women and asked permission to stay. So out of sympathy, the girl said yes. But they were all of them deceived. Because according to Ed Warren, when they investigated the case, the Warrens concluded that the entity was not a child's spirit, but a malevolent demonic force that used the Annabelle persona as a ruse to gain trust and ultimately possess a human being. So what did the Warrens do? They took the doll from Donna for safekeeping and for spiritual containment. They performed a blessing and placed the doll in a locked glass case in their occult museum in Monroe, Connecticut, not far from where we are right now. And thus the legend of Annabelle the Haunted Doll was born, stolen by and brought to you by the imaginations of Ed and Lorraine Warren. And of course, the legend of Annabelle grew with every retelling by the Warrens and their acolytes, and eventually, hey, the public at large. Annabelle became the showcase of the Warrens' collection of supposedly haunted artifacts, right, Bob? All the things that you touched in their collection. And there it was, a locked glass box. Annabelle lived where it could no longer conduct its evil doings, and a sign on it that says, "Do not touch." You see, the real power is for those who touch the doll. If they touch that doll, they become the victim of Annabelle's evil curse, which brings misfortune, misery, injury, and possibly death to anyone unfortunate enough to touch. Now, as I mentioned, we actually got to see Annabelle among the other hoarder clutter that was in that basement. There's no other way really to describe it. All those magical cursed artifacts that they curated as part of their museum of haunted objects. So much so that the Warrens boldly proclaimed their basement, because of that collection, was the most haunted place on the planet. And they were not just selling...
I'm looking at a picture. Yeah, I know. At a picture right now, and I see Annabelle, but I also see two skulls that I actually own, identical versions of those skulls, which makes me very happy.
And you too can buy them at Amazon, I'm certain.
So, now, guys, can I ask a question?
Sure.
At this stage in your description, right, for anyone that might not know more details about Ed and Lorraine Warren, the primary question I think that people should be asking themselves is, how did they not get, if those items were truly possessed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why would they feel so secure to bring all of that into their house, like literally below them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question, Jay. And that is because Ed and Lorraine claim to have specific powers of their own and training on how to handle such things.
Either
such
that, or they were full
objects.
Of shit. One of those
that,
two.
Yeah, it was one of the two. He was a demonologist.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do you have a degree in demonology? I don't.
Have a degree in baloney.
Exactly. And Lorraine was a clairvoyant or an aura specialist. She sees auras. Everybody illuminates And for us, it was, our auras apparently weren't good because she felt that somehow science interfered with anything good going on about our auras, if I recall. All right. Well, Annabelle.
How did she phrase it, guys?
Was it the science thing?
Was it the science that did it to you or something?
Yeah, like she did. She did. She was,
oh my God.
She wanted to know how we fell from holy grace. You know, very religious people, clearly. Well, okay, Annabelle. I think most people know Annabelle from the Conjuring movie series, extremely lucrative franchise. Up to date, I checked it, $2.3 billion. This is the highest grossing horror franchise in history. $2.3 billion of gross receipts at the gate, Bob. That's crazy.
That's ridiculous.
So that's it. Annabelle's cemented into popular and horror culture. No way around it. Well, fast forward. Okay, many years. Ed dies 2006, supposedly not related to Annabelle or any other curse. Lorraine dies in 2019, also not Annabelle related. What became of Annabelle at that point? After Lorraine's death, the occult museum and the organization they founded, NESPR, N-E-S-P-R, which stands for the New England Society for Psychic Research, became maintained, still in Connecticut, by their daughter, Judy, and her husband, Tony Spera, who we mentioned on the show before. So they ran the museum. Now, the museum was ultimately, later that year, shut down because apparently had various zoning violations for many years, having this attraction in their basement. Oops. So like any good huckster, what do you do? You take your show on the road. Annabelle and many of the Warrens' collections of oddities have turned into a traveling carnival show. COVID slowed it down a little bit, but in recent years it went back on the road and it is still drawing pretty decent crowds. Here is the news item for this week related to this. His name was Dan Rivera, 54-year-old paranormal investigator and lead researcher for NESPR. He died on July 13th, 2025, in his hotel room in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, during the Devils on the Run tour featuring Annabelle the Doll. As part of the tour, Rivera was traveling around the U.S. with other members of NESPR to show off Annabelle, among some of the other things that the Warrens used to keep in their museum. His death came after he finished a three-day sold-out stop in Gettysburg, and the show was hosted by something called Ghostly Images of Gettysburg Tours at the Soldiers National Orphanage. So for what you want, you know, these places, they do host paranormal and ghost-related themed events, unfortunately.
Evan, so we got the, you know, got this collection of, like incredibly dangerous stuff, and now it was given to the daughter and the son-in-law. Mm-hmm. Now, they have the skills that Ed and Lorraine had, the magic skills?
That's a good question, Jay. Good follow-up on that. No, but I've seen pictures of each of them handling Annabelle wearing black gloves.
Oh, the gloves.
So apparently these are plus one magic items of some kind.
The gloves, they do nothing.
That allow protection against such things. They have not released the cause of death for Dan Rivera yet. They said it'll be 8 to 10 weeks before there is an official release or the investigation or whatever is concluded into his death. No foul play is suspected. It's some kind of health-related reason, but they'll tell us in a couple weeks what the cause actually was.
I predict it had something to do with a ham sandwich.
You never know. You never know. That's how Mama Cass went. And Rivera was featured as a paranormal investigator on the Travel Channel's Most Haunted Places and served as producer for a number of other shows, including Netflix's 28 Days Haunted. Anyone in the world of Netflix listen to our show, you think? I mean, would, you know, because we're available, is what I'm saying, to either come on an existing show, make a show. We would love to offer some rare insights and other things about our history, our investigations, a lot of the things we've come across in our, you know, now 30 plus years of having done a lot of this stuff. And I think that would make for an interesting, at least part of a documentary, if not a documentary unto itself. But so I'm just saying, Netflix, we're available. Give us a call. Again, no foul play expected, was suspected. But again, the history of such of Annabelle is that they're a tribute, and all these attributions are from Ed and Lorraine, from their story. So it's all ghost storytelling. That's all this is. Someone died in a motorcycle crash after they mocked the doll after visiting the Warrens in their museum. A priest had a fatal car accident when the priest said something negative, apparently, in the presence of Annabelle. People have been assaulted or had marks on their bodies, unexplained after having visited and perhaps somehow insulted Annabelle. I like this one. Even Ed Warren once had a problem. He said, on one occasion, his vehicle's brakes and power steering failed in the car. So he had to, like, you know, swerve or somehow get the car to stop. So Annabelle was the cause of that. Apparently, he was transporting Annabelle from wherever to wherever. And the way he got the car to stop, and then what he did is he sprinkled holy water on Annabelle in order to get the immediate effects or whatever curses she was putting on Ed at the time to go away. There is some speculation that Ed micturated on Annabelle. But again, that's
what
just
does that
a rumor.
Mean?
Piss on her.
Yeah, piss on her.
No, I didn't know about that one either.
Yeah, no, but there's a
the
whole
secret
angle.
Word, micturate.
Evan, there is a whole angle here that I'm surprised Ed didn't think of. He should have talked to Annabelle and said, let's open a car dealership together. You damage the cars as they drive by. I'll do the repair work. We'll split the profits.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's as good as anything else that's ever, any idea that I think has ever come out from the Warrens and their infamous history, as it were.
It's so convenient that they could just, you know, assign, you know, blame or, you know, that the doll did this, the doll did that, when, you know, some guy died in a motorcycle crash, you know. It's like, I think it's disgusting that they're making claims like that. Oh, this guy talked bad about this doll I have in my basement, and that's why, you know, this motorist died. You know, it's like, who the hell do you think you are commandeering this person's story to further your bullshit?
it got a lot of press this week because of this death and all the new, you know, and you're reading these news stories about it. And they're telling those stories again, Jay, about, you know, the Warrens claim that this happened and this happened. It's like, yeah, they gave us the same stuff. Zero evidence of any of it, obviously, was our conclusion after they showed us their best evidence and told us things. And, you know, but it was all just garbage. 100% ghost stories. They're the greatest ghost storytellers perhaps in history, but they have nothing else. That is the Warrens.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy. Okay. Guys, any clue what this is?
Well, there's multiple sounds there. Something sounded like a truck, right? Like an 18-wheeler, either pulling up or driving away. That was kind of the background. But there was also this squeaking, kind of struggling to open the pickle jar kind of noise.
Yeah,
in the
I heard that too, yeah. This one is very interesting. So I would have been able to identify this sound. And that's only because I was exposed to it. And it is something that once you hear, you kind of, you know, you can recognize it. But I couldn't imagine someone straight up guessing and getting it right. So let's get through these. Listener named Joshua White wrote in, said, "Hi, this sounds like an old push mower, the kind without a motor, and you have to push it for the blades to turn," right? So he's talking about a manual push mower, which we actually had when we were kids. It was our grandfather's push mower. And he's right. If you didn't, you know, you have to push it for the blades to go. And it was hard as hell to use. You guys remember that?
Yeah, so I had workout.
It's a brilliant invention. Yeah, no power needed. Totally green.
You have a mechanical-only push mower, yeah. Steve?
I got it for just like small area spot work. It works really well.
There we go. You got to keep the blade sharp.
You got to keep it free of rust and keep everything sharp.
Yeah. Jay, I used to have one when I lived in Danbury, and I used it mainly for the workout because it was a hell of a workout.
It's a good workout. Wow. Mm-hmm. Upper body.
I remember, like, as a kid pushing it, and like I could only get it to cut like about 6 inches of grass by the time it stopped because you got to like, you push it really hard, and you know, I wasn't big enough to keep it going. But anyway, they're hard. Anyway, that is not correct, but thanks for the memory. Mm-hmm. A listener named Dan Oberst, he gave me the pronunciation. It's Obersty. And now that I see it, I think I was wrong all these years. Like, yes, it is Obersty. Sorry about that, Dan, because I recognize your name, and I think I've read it before. So anyway, Dan said this week's Who's That Noisy is the sound from inside the equipment penthouse over an elevator shaft. Now, I think this is a good guess, for sure. Yeah, I've heard the noises that elevators make throughout the years of my life. I did get trapped in an elevator once, but I didn't hear any of these noises then. And it was completely my fault.
It was 100% your fault. I was with you.
In Italy?
Yeah. The we were doing something in there. I remember exactly what we were doing, by the way, that stopped the elevator.
Oh?
Yep.
So it was an attempt to get the elevator to stop.
No, we were trying to rub our feet on the carpet in the elevator to produce static electricity.
Well, that seems harmless.
We did it, and for some reason the elevator stopped, and then some dude had to hand crank it to get it down. And I just remember, like, somebody yelling to that guy in Italian.
We were in there for a good hour and a half.
Yeah.
Oh, that's scary.
90 minutes, really?
It was a sweat box, man.
Oh,
it was
that's
no good.
Awful.
Yes, but this noisy is not anything to do with elevator shaft, but I do hear some similarities in sounds that I've heard. Another listener named Chris Ford wrote in. He said, "Hey, Jay, is that an engine dyno? Sounds like an electric ducted fan spinning up, something being tested for near future commercial aviation applications, perhaps." Chris, you are not correct, but you are on to something. We will continue. Another listener named Jeremy Samuel wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, this is the first time I've ever felt like I might have a clue what the noise is. I think it's a jet fighter engine spinning up. Sounds like a single engine, so I'm going to say an F-16 going from stationary to moving along the runway." You know, and Jeremy, you're also in the right neighborhood, kind of. But so let's do the reveal here. I have several winners, but the first one was Ryan Hanold. And Ryan said, he said, "The sound from this week sounds like a vertical wind tunnel getting up to speed before the flyer gets in. It sounds like, now get this part, it sounds like an iFly Gen 9 tunnel, so Colorado's tunnel, Detroit's tunnel, or one of Texas's tunnels. You guys understand what's happening here?
The iFly is the indoor what?
Indoor skydiving.
Indoor skydiving, yeah.
And he said, sounds like a Gen 9 tunnel. So, and then he's naming the cities and where the recording happened. Because he knows
he knows where the Gen 9s are as opposed to the Gen 8s or the Gen 7s.
Which I think is freaking amazing that there are people, you know, like people that have these experiences, or it could be their job or, you know, whatever it is, like can get that specific. I love when Who's That Noisy produces like someone that is like, I know what it is and I'm going to tell you even more. You know, it's just really cool. All right. So, guys, I've gone indoor skydiving many times. The first time I did it was actually when we were in New Zealand for the last the tour that we went on.
Bob did outdoor skydiving at least.
Bob did real skydiving.
Yeah.
So there is, without a doubt, a huge fan. It's an electric fan, and you know they actually have to adjust the speed of the fan depending on your body weight, particularly for heavier people. You know, you can hear them turning up the knob on the fan to increase the airspeed. And it sounds exactly like this. So let me play it again and just imagine, you know, this is the operator increasing the speed of the fan. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing machine that actually can simulate skydiving, you know, because the air is moving fast enough to essentially lift you up. And, you know, I saw one of the times that I did it, you know, I saw someone who really knew what they were doing and could do some unbelievable maneuvers inside those chambers. It's incredible. It really is. And it's a lot of fun. It's a really cool thing to do. It's not so stupid expensive that you can't go give it a shot. I think it's a great experience. So if you're interested, you should go check it out. Good job, Ryan. Very cool. I'm curious. You didn't say in the email, but maybe you can email me and tell me why you know that information so well. Maybe you would put, what do you do, installs? All right, guys, I got a new noisy for you this week. This is sent in by a listener named Robert Gennardi, and here it is. Very cool. All right, guys, if you think you know what this week's noisy is or you heard something cool, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, September 20th, 2025, this year.
Yeah.
We will be in Kansas. We're doing two shows on the same day. On September 20th, we'll be doing a live SGU recording, and then we'll be doing an extravaganza that night. This includes all five of us and George Robb. And if you want to catch a glimpse of Ian, you look to the side of the stage and you might see his red hair over there. Do not look him directly in the eye. Trust me, just don't do it. Go to theskepticsguide.org to buy tickets, to check it out, whatever you want to do. There's information there, but we'd really love it if you could join us. There's still tickets left for both of the shows, so please check it out.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items, or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. What do you think it is?
I think it's crazy politicians.
Italy.
Close.
Or meatballs. Sicily. Sicily.
It's close. It's Malta.
Malta.
So I think most people know next to nothing about Malta, right? It's just
because there is nothing next to Malta.
No, there's stuff there.
These are
three facts I encountered while visiting Malta. All right, here we go. Item number one. Despite being a small island nation notoriously cramped for space, Malta has one of the highest cars per capita in the world and the highest in the EU. Item number two, Malta contains among the oldest freestanding structures in the world, megalithic temples older than the pyramids at Giza and Stonehenge. And item number three, the national bird of Malta is the peregrine falcon, with a large breeding population on the main island. Evan, go first.
Highest cars per capita in the world. Okay. Wish I knew what the population of Malta is. I don't know. But it's small. Well, you could walk the entire main island, I think, in a day, right? It's really not that big. So if you had, I don't know, if you had 100,000 people on that island, maybe that could do it. That could do it. I have a feeling that one is science. I also have a feeling the second one is science. Some of the oldest freestanding structures in the world, and I guess I'll use what little I can retain from the movie Patton, in which a scene in which General Patton and his entourage visit Malta, and he's giving a tour to some people of the press and others, and he's explaining certain things and how it is like one of the it's history of warfare and stuff. So yeah, that could have some of the oldest freestanding structures in the world. Definitely this last one about the peregrine falcon. So what's it eating? Right? If I knew more about falcons, maybe I'd have a better idea of, in case this one is science. But I have a feeling it's fiction, because I just don't know that there would be enough to... the national bird, hold on, with a large breeding population on the main island. Yeah, no, I'll say it's something else. It's not the peregrine falcon. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
So... oldest freestanding structures, most cars per capita, large breeding population of peregrines. Peregrine seems realistic. Oldest freestanding structures, I feel like, how do you define that? Can it be ruins?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, cars, though. I guess the Italians do love their cars, but I don't know. I feel like that... it would have to have like one of the highest GDPs also for that to be the case. And I don't think I know of Malta as being one of the richest countries in the world. So maybe I'll say that one's the fiction, because I don't think it's one of the richest. So I don't think it would have the most cars per capita.
Okay, Bob.
You did say that traffic was crazy. So that kind of makes me think that the highest cars per capita is possible. And if freestanding structures. I know there's lots of temples there, so maybe that's going to be related to that. So I'll say that one's probably science as well. Yeah, the peregrine falcon one just seems like it doesn't fit. But I don't know. But I'm just going to say it anyway. Falcon fiction.
Okay, and Jay.
Steve, you did say to me and Bob that driving there was crazy, and you couldn't figure out which way to go. like he was being driven by someone, and he couldn't rationalize which way the car was going to go, right? So that's crazy. But that doesn't mean that there's a lot of cars there, but you were thinking about cars. The one about the, oldest freestanding structures in the world. I believe that one is science, because there's some pretty cool stuff there. There is a temple to Hercules there.
Hercules.
That was Sicily, Jay.
Oh, whatever.
Oh, you gave him. You gave him a little.
I felt so smart, Steve. I felt so smart.
He remembered it. He just misremembered.
But I know there's cool stuff there, because Steve and I talked extensively about this. So I'm going to stick with that. Okay. So we're left with the Boyds and the cars. Which one? Steve is a birder, and he likes bird details. Kara, I'm trying so hard to logic something into this. I have no clue.
What bird of anything in Malta?
I mean, the only thing I have to say is I would think it would be some type of seabird of that, you know, because it's like an island. It's small. It's got to be an animal that deals with the ocean in one way or the other.
Jay, I have with me my science or fiction coin. Do you want me to use it?
All right, Bob. It's going to be between the cars and the bird. So let's do this. because you picked the bird, you flip it for the bird, and if it comes up fiction, I'll go with you.
You said okay? Flip the bird.
Oh, yeah. You flipped a coin about the bird. All right, it's great. Go ahead,
Bob. Doing it now. Fiction.
All right, I'm with Bob, Steve. The bird, it is not that bird. It is another bird. It's a seabird. Thank you.
Damn.
All right, so you're leaving Tara all out on her own there.
Yeah.
But you guys all agree on the middle one. So we'll start there. Malta contains among the oldest freestanding structures in the world. Megalithic temples older than the pyramids of Giza and Stonehenge. You all think that one is science, and that one is science. That is science. Malta is freaking old. It was
old.
You know, conquered by so many different forces over the earth. Phoenicians.
Oh gosh. Look where it is on the map. I know. You can understand
Malta,
why.
The
it's
Maltans.
Like, hello.
And then and then the Greeks, and then
Carthaginians.
There were the Hospitallers were in charge for a while. Then they had to bribe Spain not to conquer them at one point. and then it was a English colony for 150 years.
I say.
Finally gained its independence and became an independent nation in 1975. So it has a long history of multiple wave after wave after wave of colonization and conquering and everything. And it's a mix of different cultures for that reason.
And of course, whoever conquers first is going to put all their structures up there.
Yeah, going back, there are these megalithic temples there, older than the pyramids of Giza and Stonehenge, you know, going back 3,000-4,000 years BC, among the oldest in the world. Not the oldest, but we had this conversation too. It depends on what you count as a freestanding structure, but these are on the short list. Okay, let's go to number two. Let's go to number three. The national bird of Malta is the peregrine falcon, with a large breeding population on the main island. I'm really surprised.
Maltese falcon.
That none of you mentioned the Maltese falcon.
Well, I strategically didn't mention it.
Okay. Because falconry is in fact very popular on Malta.
However.
It has been for a long time, but this is the fiction. It's a fiction for a couple of reasons. Couple of reasons. First of all, the national bird of Malta is the blue rock thrush.
Was that like the first thing you looked up when you were researching Malta?
Of course it is.
The blue rock thrush. And because the falcon was actually endangered on Malta and they had to reintroduce it, and it's just starting to make a comeback. So there isn't a large breeding population on the main island.
Is it a seabird, Steve?
At the present time, no, it's a thrush.
Come on. All right, I'm happy anyway.
But there is a connection with falconry and Malta. But the Maltese falcon, you know what the connection of that is to Malta?
No. Yes.
There is none?
Nothing. It was a novel that was made into a movie. It has no basis in reality. It's pure fiction.
Yeah. Probably Humphrey Bogart's second most famous film.
Right. But yeah, they falcons live on the island and they hunt stuff, Evan. You know, there's lots of... It's not that far from Sicily. And by the way, Cara, it's not Italian. Malta has nothing to do with Italy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's near it.
It's just... It's close to it, but culturally, it is completely different. So
no, but I'm just saying, like, in terms of, like, importing, it's right there.
Oh,
there are two languages. There are two official languages of
Arabic.
Malta. Maltese and English.
Oh, English.
Maltese.
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Is a Semitic language. It's not Italian. Oh. It's a Semitic language. It's because of their Arabic influence.
Yeah.
And English, because it was an English colony for 150 years, right? In fact, so like one of our tour guides was saying that like 20, 30 years ago, you know, children were learned Maltese as their primary language and English as their secondary language. And today, it's really the other way around. They really learn English as their primary language and Maltese as their secondary language, just because it's such a much more of an international language. And, of course, Malta is becoming more and more of a popular destination for tourists. But having said that, Cara, it is a popular destination for Italian tourists because it is so close. Mm-hmm. And so there is a huge Italian influence there now. But historically, culturally, it's not Italian. It has nothing to do with it. It's in the EU, and it's they drive on the left there because it was a British colony, whereas they drive on the right in Italy, including Sicily. Anyway, interesting. And I heard the language, and it's unique, but you could tell that it's a Semitic language. But it has a lot. So there's a lot of introduced foreign words into their language, right? Anything modern, basically, they use the English word. Anything food related, they basically use the Italian word that was introduced just from the introduction of that. But there's a lot of Arabic words as well. Interesting, very interesting culture. Okay. That means that despite being a small island nation notoriously cramped for space, Malta has one of the highest cars per capita in the world, and the highest in the EU is science. And it is crazy. Now, it's the reason why, guys, what I was telling you is that the streets were not really made for cars, right? And the streets are
very narrow.
They're very narrow. It's like it was like you're on the edge of your seat the whole time. You're driving in that car going from point A to point B, like – you don't know what's going to happen next. If you're not obviously a native, it was quite an experience. And we chose not to drive ourselves on the island. So we were only like we you Ubered it when we Uber. Had to. Yeah, we would walk.
Do you know why I think I got that wrong?
Why is that?
Other than just not knowing.
You misunderstood the.
Yeah, I read it as the most cars per capita, not one of the most.
One of the most in the world, but the most in the EU.
Yeah. Right. I don't know why I read it as the most in the world.
But it's pretty high. It's pretty high on the list, just not number one. You guys want...
I just looked it up. It's below the U.S.
It's just below the U.S.
Yeah.
It's...
But yeah, most of the countries above it are like tiny countries.
They're tiny
like
countries, yeah.
Gibraltar and Liechtenstein and San Marino.
So it's number 11 on the list, although Taiwan is out of sequence on the list. I don't know why that is. But anyway, so Evan, the population, 532,000.
On that small, wow, that's a lot of
people. With 438,000 cars. There's 438,000 cars on that little tiny island. And I totally believe that having been there. It was, there's a lot of people driving around.
Is it all petrol or did you have any electric vehicles?
It was both. There were some electric vehicles.
Right. At least there's some. Okay.
But it was mostly ICE engines. And just like no public transportation. You know, there's just no infrastructure for that.
Which is weird.
What's the Maltese word for
tiny.
Uber?
It's Uber. they borrow English words for most modern technology.
Hence
stuff.
My funny comment.
Yeah.
Brand name. Yeah.
Even like comb, the word for comb in Maltese is comb. You know, they just.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay. Very cool place. It is fun to visit a place I know almost nothing about. You know, I just didn't really know much about it until we went there. Very cool.
I'm glad you were adventurous that way.
Yeah, yeah. So we went there specifically because my wife had a conference there, but they do conferences in interesting places like this. And it's we almost went to Malaysia a few years ago for this conference.
Ah.
But it was canceled because of COVID, which was a shame because one of her co-workers is from Malaysia. And they were going to host us and show us around. We were really looking forward to it.
Ooh,
all got canceled local. Due to COVID. It was shame.
That would have been perfect.
I know.
Damn shame.
You know, now that she's a tenured professor, she may be going to these conferences every year. We'll see what interesting places they take us to. Anyway, so good job, guys.
Thank you.
Good job.
I mean, it was a coin flip. I mean, really.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote was suggested by listener Steve from Saskatchewan. Thank you for so much. Ignorance is the most delightful science in the world because it is acquired without labor or pains and keeps the mind from melancholy. Giordano Bruno, Italian philosopher, in the late 1500s, I think.
Hang
on. Yep. Born February 15th. 1548, yeah. Italian philosopher, poet, alchemist, astrologer, among other things. He's known for his cosmological theories, which conceptually extended to include the then novel Copernican model. Mm-hmm. Whoa, so a little ahead of his time, huh?
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Of course, Steve.
Welcome back.
Thank you. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.